The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. On July 16th, the organization Stop the Drug War, Drug Reform Coalition Network, held a side event at the UN's High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development. It was titled Human Rights Challenge, Judicial and Extrajudicial Drug War Killings in a Time of Authoritarianism. Not surprisingly, there was quite a lot of talk about the Philippines, where a murderous campaign against the poor, the disenfranchised, has been waged by that nation's dictator, Rodrigo Duterte. Thousands and thousands of people have been murdered senselessly, needlessly, by the police and by vigilante death squads in the Philippines under the guise of a war on drugs. One of the people at this forum who appeared via Skype was Justin Balan. Justin is a representative of Akbayan Youth, which is a democratic socialist youth and students formation that works for the realization of good governments and transformative politics. They're a youth wing of the Akbayan Citizens Action Party. More than being a youth wing of its mother party, Akbayan Youth is an independent and autonomous left, democratic socialist and feminist youth movement in the Philippines, working for freedom, equality, and solidarity all over the world. Now let's hear from Justin.
Hello, again, I'm Justin from Akbayan Youth in the Philippines, and I'm also the ambassador for students for sensitive drug policy in the Philippines. And I'm going to share about how Duterte's drug war undermines democracy in my country, and how the youth and children are bearing the brunt of the drug war's form. The week that the Philippine government congratulated the Thai government that celebrated the rescue of the Thai boys trapped in a cave was the week when the government's deadly campaign against drugs killed a four-year-old boy in Cebu City in the Philippines. The four-year-old boy was named Skyler Abatayo, and he was just learning how to ride his own mane when he was killed by a stray bullet that pierced through his heart while he was in his room doing his assignment. And he was caught in a crossfire in a government hut for people suspected of drugs. The cases, including Abatayo, is ironic as Duterte's early campaign was much touted to be a protection for children and a future generation against what Duterte and his allies would call the drug menace. But as of April 2018, reports test that 74 minors have already been killed in police operations and vigilante style attacks, according to data from Philippine-based Children's Legal Rights and Development Center. These minors were killed, either targeted in police operations, they were either killed in vigilante style killings or caught in a crossfire in deadly drug hunt operations. The stories include 12-year-old Christine Joyce Aquilo, who was just attending mass with her mother, when she was shot. 4-year-old Atea Barbon, whose father was a drug suspect, she was shot in the back during a police operation. And as his father was speeding away from the police, he was on the motorcycle and she was unfortunately shot. There were also two minors in Maguindanao. Maguindanao is a depressed area in the southern Philippines. One was an infant and another was a teenager, and they were killed on May 2017. So President Duterte is known to tag these deaths, especially of minors and children, as collateral damages fit his drug war narrative. Now, I think it's important to stress that President Duterte will have his State of the Nation address on July 23, 2018. His war on drugs then will enter its third year. But the public continues to be hounded by a program called the hashtag RealNumbersPH, where they show what they say are accurate government data in which the figures are different from what is shown in media operations and what is reported by human rights groups but several journalists have criticized the government data because some of the terms and numbers were adjusted so that the killings that happened in police operations would be significantly reduced. And so these government data rely so much on semantics and different legal terms in order to cleanse and sanitize the latest drug war. But different academic organizations and universities have come up with a project that would study and analyze trends and patterns of the drug war. They have released this last month on July 26. It's called the Drug Archive Philippines, and it's a project between De La Salle University, Ateneo de Manila University, University of the Philippines, and Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. And it was a project that studied and analyzed trends and patterns from news reports involving drug war killings. And one of the theories that have been highlighted in this report was that government drug war operations may have involved vigilantes. So in this report, they have observed that the killings arising from police operations and killings arising from vigilante-style incidents surge and drop in cases at the same time, depending on pronouncements from the Duterte administration. So one of the cases that they've cited was in January 2017, after the death of a foreign businessman named G.H. Ju in a drug-related case, the drug war of the Philippine government was suspended for a time, and the cases of deaths from police operations and from vigilante style killings were said to have dropped through. And in March, in the same year, when the drug war was reactivated, it surged again, depended on the next day. So this really highlights how the suspicions of some groups that government operations may involve vigilante-style killings. And these vigilante-style killings have ended up on headlines in the world all over, where people are gruesomely killed. Sometimes they're wrapped in plastic, sometimes they're wrapped in duct tape, and they have different wounds. But the most stark signs that are left for them are cardboard pieces, cardboards where it says, I am a drug pusher, don't be like me, that have been believed to have sprouted as soon as President Duterte took power. And this also, this could also be a damning evidence of how some cops may have moonlighted as vigilantes. There have been news reports that in October 2016, in Oriental Mindoro, there have been cops that are caught named Senior Inspector Magdalino Pineda Jr., Inspector Marson Alvarez. They've been caught moonlighting as vigilante killers, but according to an editorial by Inquirer 2017, although they have been removed at the time, they have been reinstated with their ranks untouched. Some developments too. The Supreme Court has demanded an explanation from the Philippine government on the thousands of deaths involving the drug war. But this was before the Chief Justice was ousted through a co-warrant petition. I'm quoting a report from Rappler, a news organization here. Supreme Court took judicial notice of the 2017 year and report of the Duterte administration, where deaths related to cases of illegal drugs and internal cleansing conducted within the Philippine National Police are touted as accomplishments. So according to the Supreme Court, basically is asking the government for data on the drug war, explaining why there have been an average of 39.46 deaths every day from July 1, 2016 to November 27, 2017. This was a total, according to the Supreme Court, a total of 20,322 deaths during the Duterte administration's anti-drug war. But despite all these cases, people are already fighting back. President Duterte's satisfaction ratings have dropped. According to the Social Weather Survey, days before his State of the Nation address. So what we're doing, civil society organizations, human rights organizations, are basically reforming government policies at the local level. This month, we have invited local government leaders to take and train them into the harm reduction approach to solve drug-related issues in their community, shying them away from the approach that the administration is promoting, wherein they wanted to basically kill people suspected of pushing or using drugs. Our organizations have also provided intervention for families affected by the drug war. There have been interventions in terms of giving them psychosocial help, giving them legal help in order to attain justice for cases, especially involving police sanctioned deaths. And at the same time, from my level, we have been mobilizing and organizing young people to learn more about their human rights, and at the same time, to be more aware of the drug war killings that has been happening here in the Philippines. So those are some of the cases and progress that has been happening here in the Philippines, and goes to show that the drug war really undermines democracy.
That was Justin Balen from Akbayan Youth. He was speaking at an event on July 16th, a side event at the UN's High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development. The event was organized by DRCNet and Stop the Drug War. It was titled Human Rights Challenge, Judicial and Extrajudicial Drug War Killings in a Time of Authoritarianism. One of the people in attendance at that panel was Levi Batista. The Reverend Dr. Levi Batista is Assistant General Secretary for United Nations Ministry and Church and Society of the United Methodist Church. He's headquartered at the UN Office for the Church Center for the United Nations in New York. Let's hear from Dr. Batista.
Hi, I'm Levi Batista. I represent the United Methodist Church at the United Nations. Thank you very much for the speakers. I think as a church person, let me put some context. In the last 6 months, an Episcopal Anglican-related bishop was detained by the Duterte government. Two Roman Catholic priests were executed at the point of hold at the time when they were preparing for Mass. Three United Methodist missionaries were expelled by the Duterte government. Now, just about a few days ago, a United Methodist missionary from Malawi, three of them assigned in Mindanao at the In Peace, which is an organization related with the peace process. I think part of the context of the extrajudicial killings in the Philippines must be taken note of, which is the criminalization of poverty and the criminalization of political acts. In other words, there is in fact an ongoing insurgency in the Philippines, and the drug war provides for a cover for political killings. And I think that should not be forgotten, that in fact, the assault on the poor is an assault on the base of political organizing. And therefore, the pretext for the killing of many of the poor people, being people who are drug addicts or related to the drug trade, is a pretext for quashing, decimating a base for political organizing within democratic forces in the Philippines. So, but the larger context of that is that the democratic institutions have been so decimated, owing way back to the Marcos dictatorship, and therefore the assault on the judiciary and the legislature, the co-optation of both institutions by the executive, by the Duterte government, has rendered, has therefore imperiled, I should say, political dissent. And so extrajudicial killing, detention, arbitrary arrest and detention are not just on the rise, but have been steadily happening even all the way back to martial law. The fourth item I think that should not be forgotten is the patronage of the U.S. government of the Philippine government. And that connects Mr. Duterte with Mr. Trump, the two administrations. And we need to connect, for example, this discussion with the high-level political forum, perhaps with the Agenda 2030, which should be and in relation to the U.S. government, the U.S. support for what is called the Millennium Fund, Millennium Challenge Fund, and the support for the military in the Philippines must be attached. Lastly, I think it was important for our resource persons to mention the situation of Mindanao and why martial law in Mindanao. Martial law in Mindanao provides for the context of what Mr. Duterte wants the Philippine Constitution to be changed to change the Republic into a federal government. So the federalization of the Philippines provides for an easy control of political and economic warlords of specific territories, Mindanao being Mr. Duterte's area. So those should not be lost in the conversation, albeit we're zeroing in on this, on the drug war. The context, the economic and political context of the Philippines and the complicity of the U.S. with its economy and with its politics should always be taken into consideration. Thank you.
That was the Reverend Dr. Levi Batista, Assistant General Secretary for United Nations Ministry with Church and Society of the United Methodist Church. Many thanks to DRCNet for live streaming this event. You can see the entire thing at Stop the Drug War Facebook page. Or you can also stop by their website at stopthedrugwar.org. You are listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. From international to the local, let's take a look at law enforcement-assisted diversion in the United States. Speaking with Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori and Karen Kern, who's the Senior Director of Substance Use Disorder Services at Central City Concerns. And we're talking about the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program that's here in Multnomah County. It's the national thing, and we have one of the operating programs. Just to start, for the benefit of the listener, could you please tell me how what is Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion about?
Sure, I'll start that off. And then Karen, I'm sure, has a lot more detail to how the program's working. Really, the idea behind this is that we, the local community here in Multnomah County, didn't want to reinvent the wheel. We really try to look around the country at other best practices and see where people are have programs that are successful in helping people in their community. And this was one of those programs we found in King County, just our neighbors right to the north. And the way it works is law enforcement who are out patrolling the streets of our town on a daily basis come across people that they see over and over again, the same person. They see Jim on the corner, they see Sally under the bridge, the same folks. And they get to a relationship with them. They get to know them, and they want to be able to offer them something else besides a trip to the jail. And they know that giving somebody a trip to the jail just is going to turn around. They'll be right back out on the street again soon, not actually addressing the reasons that they're in the situations that they're in. So through the LEAD program, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, law enforcement has another tool. They can ask people if they want to be a part of a program that is administered by Central City Concern where people get the services that they need. They have access to drug and alcohol counseling. They have access to housing. They have access to mental health treatment. They have access to a friend. And that has shown through the other communities where this program exists that it's successful.
Now, Karen, on an operational level, I mean, you administer the program. So what does it look like from the ground, I guess?
Yeah, so there are two ways to get into LEAD. We have the arrest diversion process, which is officers come across somebody that is currently at risk for arrest for possession of controlled substance. And then we also have the social contact or social referral method, where people can refer individuals who are either have been arrested in the past for PCS or are at risk for arrest in the future and are using substances illegally. And so the arrest diversion, how it works is the officers encounter an individual on the street who is in the process of breaking the law with a PCS offense, and they offer the individual the LEAD program. It is a voluntary program, and it is a harm reduction program. So the only thing that the individual needs to say, if they're interested, is, yes, I'm interested. And they contact our screening and outreach coordinator, who is able to then meet them either on the corner or at the precinct or wherever is comfortable. And they do a warm handoff at that point, officer to case manager. And then the case manager picks it up from there and does a screen, makes sure that the individual is actually interested in the program, explains how it works, and then assigns them to a case manager. And then we do outreach to that person to in the next 30 days or so, continuously, until we can find them again and get them assessed to try to figure out what some of the issues they may want to work on are. And then it's really up to that individual to put together a plan. It's a self-directed plan. So instead of many treatment programs where somebody is, enrolled into a program and prescribed a treatment plan, this program is truly harm reduction, and all we ask is that they complete the assessment and then continue to work with us. And then they get to set the plan goals themselves.
So, the only problem. I'm a data guy. So do you have some, the program's been in operation for about a year now. So I guess roughly, I mean, it was, we spoke about it back in March of 2017 and it was just about to get underway. So you've had at least several months. What kind of numbers are you looking at? How many folks were involved in the program? How many contacts have they made? I mean, yeah, give me some numbers.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So we have currently, as of today, 117 clients enrolled in the program. We have, I would say, it's about 48% arrest referrals and 52% social contact referrals. And that number just fluctuates based on who the officers encounter and want to refer in. We have met over about 2,500 individual needs in the amount of time that we've been running. And we have actually a pretty good track record of meeting needs that were identified by individuals. So, for example, a lot of people that we encounter need physical health needs or medical needs. They haven't been engaged with primary care or enrolled even in primary care, and often have chronic medical conditions that are not being taken care of. So usually that's one of the first needs that they identify as wanting help with. And we're at 93% in assisting people getting their medical needs met. In addition, housing, the majority of the clients in our program are coming to us with chronic homelessness, street homelessness, not just unstably housed. And we have currently 23% of those people in engaged in housing services. We have also, let's see, what else can I say? We've got multiple people not just housed, but also working in completed treatment programs for substance use disorders, sober, and people who tried different programs in the past and just, nothing really was working for them. So just the approach, I think, of this program, and again, it being a harm reduction approach and really be self-directed by the client, the relationship that's built with the case manager that's not pressured, like you have to do this, really works in our favor in terms of building that engagement and trust, and then people just saying, yeah, I really want help with this. How can you help me?
Social contact referrals, that's, you said 42%, was that?
It's actually about 52% social contact and 48% arrest diversion currently, but that number fluctuates just based on who the officers encounter in the course of their day. We just enrolled an arrest referral today.
Okay, so 52%. That was actually one of my questions, because, of course, the two different routes, the arrest pre-booking is, how do we say it? There's still an arrest happening, so they're still making that kind of connection. But the idea of doing the social contact referral, leads into another thing, because the lead National Bureau's document outlining the core principles for policing says that forcing people to rely on arrest as the sole means of referral can be counterproductive and can delay engagement. Officers who become accustomed to using lead may eventually come to regard arrest as a strategy of last resort for low-level drug offenses and offenses related to behavioral health conditions and or poverty. Can either of you speak to how I see lead as being a positive thing, because it may help with a cultural change within law enforcement, so that arrest does become the last resort, especially when you're dealing with the low-level drug offenses and offenses that relate to behavioral health conditions and that relate to poverty. Could either of you speak to that sort of culture change thing?
Sure, I can start. I, for me personally, this was one of the reasons that I was interested in the program in the first place. In this particular program, I think that there was a desire when we were first looking at LEAD, a question of whether we needed to have the law enforcement angle. Couldn't we just have caseworkers who are out walking the streets, encountering people and saying, hey, come into this program? But that's the highlight for me of this program, is it gives law enforcement an additional tool that they didn't have before, and it allows them to see success. I recently sat through a operations meeting with caseworkers from Central City, law enforcement, folks from the DA's office, and some of our national partners who were here to look at the program, and listening to the conversation about individuals. They were talking about individual and whether the program would be right for them, whether they should stay in the program. And it was really, I just felt so warmed by the conversation where they were talking about a certain individual, and the officer said, I never thought I would see her clean and sober. I never thought I would see her. I thought I would, next time I would see her, I would, or hear from her, I would find out that she had died. And instead, she's on a totally different path now. And so showing law enforcement that there are harm reduction programs that work, change people's lives, I think it's really, as I said, it's for me the highlight of the program.
That was a portion of my interview with Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori and Karen Kern, who's the Senior Director of Substance Use Disorder Services at Central City Concern in Portland, Oregon. We were speaking about the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, or LEAD, program that's been operating in Portland for the last year. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.